Good morning, both. Thank you very much for coming to give evidence to us. We are asking you to give evidence together to try and be as efficient as possible, and also because there are some questions that one or other of you may well be able to more suitably answer, or both of you may well wish to make a contribution. I will try and direct my questions to one or the other of you, but if you feel that it's been misdirected, please don't hesitate to say so, and I will ask the other, who then hopefully can provide me with some assistance. We will not be having a break until lunchtime now. Just a few other preliminary matters which I suspect you've heard. Firstly, this isn't a test of memory. I know you will have made notes. Please feel free to refer to them or to your witness statement or any other documents. Secondly, we can have breaks and as often as you want or need. Please just raise your hand and I can organise that. Next, there are bundles in front of you. Now, both of you have a bundle each. Chair and panel, just for your purposes, it's F1 tab 2, F1 tabs 1 and 2, and F1 tab 1, 3 and 4. So we have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to witness statements from the both of you, but what I'm probably going to suggest is most of the time we'll be looking at things on screen, but I will give you the tab reference if you need them. Miss Coley, I will take you first. There are two witness statements from you. One dated September 2019 from you. One dated September 2019 from Miss Richards, but in effect you made a large measure of factual contribution to. That's ISI 001594. Can you just turn to that particular witness statement, Miss Coley?
Yes.
It's only two pages in length.
Oh, my statement.
Yes, just your statement.
Yes.
In that statement, you in effect indicate and adopt large portions of Kate Richards' statement of the 28th of August 2019. Is that right?
Yes.
And have you had an opportunity to read both this statement and that statement of Miss Richards recently?
Yes.
And is it still true to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Fine. So what we're going to do is largely, for your benefit, Chair and Panel, is rely on the witness statement of Miss Richards dated the 28th of August, which is ISI 001576. That is a Chair and Panel, I think that's a F1A tab 3, just so you know. Right. Sorry, that's the administrative our end. Miss Coley, perhaps you'd just like to tell us briefly about your background and experience in inspecting boarding schools.
Oh, in inspecting boarding schools.
Yes.
My background in boarding is that I was a teacher at a boarding school. I was not involved in the day-to-day boarding side, but I would be helping with care some evenings, and I would certainly be helping with trips and so on out at the weekends. As far as my boarding experience is concerned, before 2012, when ISI took over the boarding, I was involved in inspecting schools where Ofsted were the boarding side of the inspection, and we worked together, and I would like to feel that we worked together well. But then when 2012 came along and ISI was taking over the boarding, as inspectors, we were all lead inspectors, we were all retrained very carefully in the NMS and the expectations of the boarding side of the whole inspection. And then I think I have led, I don't know exactly, but I would think probably about 40 boarding inspections since that time.
So since 2012?
Yes.
Thank
you. But that's an approximation.
Okay. That's very helpful. Turning now to Ms. Richards, we have two witness statements from you, one dated the 15th of August 2019, one dated the 28th of August 2019. And they are ISI 000-1574 and ISI 000-1576. Again, could I ask you to turn to the last page, firstly, of 1574, which I think is behind tab 2 of your bundle.
Yes.
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 Did you sign this document? I know your signature is covered over for data protection reasons.
Yes, I did.
And is it true to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes, it is.
Now, as I understand it, Ms. Richards, and as you explain within your witness statement, within both of your witness statements, you identify that, in a way, it's a corporate witness statement. So you've asked various individuals and you've had to piece things together from the records because you only became chief inspector in 2017. Is
yes,
that right?
That's correct.
And could I also ask you to turn to the rear of ISI 001576, which I think is behind tab 2 of your bundle. It's behind tab 2 of mine, anyway, and it's 29 pages long. Can you also indicate whether or not you signed that witness statement?
Yes, I did.
And again, is it true to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes, it is.
And again, the same caveats apply in that sometimes you are telling us things within that witness statement which are not within your own direct knowledge, but which have been either found out from other individuals in the ISI or from paperwork that is available.
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. Just to set a little bit of background, and I'm not sure whether Miss Richards or Miss Coley is best to answer these questions. Miss Richards, I think if I direct some basic questions to you and then some issues around what happened in 2011 to Miss Coley, the ISI has since 2001 inspected schools that are members of organisations allied to the Independent Schools Council. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
But until 2012, that simply involved looking at educational standards
yes,
rather than boarding welfare.
Yes, it did. And as Liz mentioned, Ofsted were responsible for boarding yes, welfare.
So until 2012, Ofsted did all boarding welfare and the ISI did educational standards.
And other inspectorates as well, previous to Ofsted.
Yes, yes. So, and what we're really looking at is the period between 2010 and 2014 for the purposes of today. And so you as an organisation would have, until 2012, only looked at the education side of things.
Yes.
And that, as I understand it, means inspecting, for the purposes of statutory inspections, inspecting against the independent school standards as they were.
Yes, that's correct.
As they were and are.
Yes.
And they first came into force in 2002, and then they were amended in 2010, and then in 2014. Is that right?
That's correct.
But they've been amended, but not... They've been amended in some ways, but they haven't been radically revised, or would you disagree with that?
No, there have been some changes and iterations yeah, over time.
Yes. However, in respect of the boarding element, the statutory basis of which comes from the Children Act 1989, Section 87, you inspect against a different body of standards, which is the National Minimum Standards. Is that right?
Yes.
And again, those were issued in 2002, then they were revised in 2011, and then I think they were revised again in 2015.
I'm unsure of the dates, but yes, there were yeah, revisions.
Right. OK. And as I understand it, if you... Although they are two different things and they're looking at different things, if you fail, shall we say, the National Minimum Standards, the boarding welfare bit, you can't pass now the Education Independent School Standards bit.
That's
Is
correct.
That right?
That's correct.
And has that always been the case or has that changed?
I believe that to have always been the case.
Okay. All right. So... from 2012 onwards, you would therefore have been able to run what's called integrated inspections. What does that mean to the layperson?
So an integrated inspection would look at all aspects of a school's provision. So where there was boarding, we would include looking at boarding, early years, for example. So an inspection would cover everything that a school offered, whether that be against the NMS or indeed the early years, and of course against the ISSR, which are the school regulations.
Right. And how do you think that's helped you as an inspection service in identifying the culture of a school? One of the issues we're very concerned about in this inquiry is managing the culture of a school. How has the change from being education only to being education and boarding impacted upon your ability to assess the culture of school and the culture of safeguarding?
Well, I think when we're inspecting safeguarding, it's so important to consider everything that we see during an inspection. So whilst there are specific activities we would undertake which would link clearly and obviously to safeguarding, such as checking the single central register for appointments of new staff, references, etc., there are also multiple other activities which occur which give us information about what goes on in that school. What is it like for children in that school? So that integration enables us to use every single piece of inspection activity. Observation, for example, in a lesson might give us information about how children's voices are heard. It might give us information about the boundaries and about what relationships are like. All of that contributes to that understanding of the culture in that school.
And do you think that that's been, do you think that was able to be as accurately or as in-depth when you were just looking at the education side of things in boarding settings?
I'm not sure, since that predates my own knowledge and experience, I'm not sure I'm qualified to comment on it.
Miss Coley, I believe you would be able to qualify and comment upon it.
Yes, I mean, I'm afraid to say that it could occasionally depend on the way the inspectorates worked together. But generally, yes, I think if you were working well with your colleague from the other inspectorate, then, you could get a reasonable view of what was going on. Because, after all, you're both looking at welfare, health and safety, pastoral care of the children.
Okay.
So I think you could get a pretty good view, but I would say that it is better now that we are focused on the whole school in getting to the depth of how safe are the children there and how well are they cared for.
Yeah. So you've talked about working well with your colleague. Now, that would have been if people had been on site at the same time.
Yes.
Now, if one looks at the inspection history of Cheetham's, one sees there was an independent schools inspectorate report of Cheetham's in 2008, which was of what I'm going to call the education side. So that's 6 years before the inspection we're going to look at in depth, which is the 2013. Was that a routine length of time between inspections at that time, that the education would only be inspected roughly once every 6 years? Or was that an unusual length of time?
Yes, that was the time frame.
So it was a once every 6 year education inspection. Is that too long? I mean, now I understand, or I think it's every 3 years there's some form of inspection.
Once we'd taken over the boarding, the overall cycle remained 6 years, but every 3 years, so in the interim period, boarding schools had an inspection against the national minimum standards for residential schools.
Okay. So somebody, there will be an inspection every 3 years. That's the current position.
Currently,
of some
yes.
sort.
We now have a different framework, but yes, that is it. That's true.
Right. Okay. And can I just identify, so there was a ISI inspection in 2008. There's then an Ofsted inspection in 2011. And then there's an inspection that you, as the independent schools inspector, undertook along with Manchester Children's Services in 2013. And so this was quite an unusual inspection. Miss Coley, perhaps you'd like to tell us why. Have you ever been involved in an inspection before which has involved you and a children's services department going in together to look at a school?
No. That's why it was unique, in that we were working together. The DfE had asked, my understanding from the office is that the DfE had asked that ISI should go in alongside the Manchester Children's Services, which is indeed what we did. But it's the only inspection I've ever done that way, and I've done more than 164 inspections.
Right. Did it work well?
Very. Yes.
And why did it work so well?
It did work well, but I think it was because we were... We had clearly subdivided the areas of work so that both teams were clear about what we were looking for. However, we were in the same team room. We shared our thoughts right from the word go. Every lunchtime and evening we would have a meeting to discuss what we were finding in the various areas mm-hmm. that we were looking at. So yes, it worked well, but I must say that what we were doing at that school, the activities that were happening were the same activities that I would carry out on an ordinary inspection, except that this time we were looking in more depth because of the issues that had been raised.
Yes. So this inspection wasn't a routine inspection.
No.
It came as a result of a direct instruction from the Department for Education.
Yes.
And in fact, they didn't just give you a direct instruction. They said, we would like you in particular to look at certain areas.
Yes, in those days it would have been what we called an emergency inspection,
yeah.
But an emergency inspection in those days would have been a one-day inspection with two inspectors normally. But
okay.
Because of the situation here, there were two on the ISI team for 2 days.
Okay. I think it might be quite useful for us just to get up paragraph 15 of your witness statement, which identifies the areas which you, of 001576, Ralph, please, 005, which should be paragraph 15 of the witness statement of Miss Richards, but to which I believe Miss Coley. So this was the commission that the DfE gave you. What is this unusual in its degree of prescription or usual?
I think in this particular instance, I think it was slightly more descriptive. But when the DfE asks for what we used to call emergency visits or unannounced visits, the description is pretty tight on what you're wanted to look at, be it complaints, safeguarding, bullying, whatever it might be. The DfE are pretty prescriptive in what they want you to do.
Does that therefore mean you can't look outside that? Or is that just, that's the minimum you have to look at? If you find anything else, you need to tell us about it.
I was going to say if there is time, that's true, because these are normally one-day, two-man visits. So you are going in with particular areas that you have to look at. If on the way you notice something else, then you may well stop and look at that, or you would certainly bear it in mind that you've noticed something that might not be quite right. I think I can think of a couple of inspections where, in fact, that did happen. But generally, you are in focused on,
yeah,
because the time is as it is.
And just for reference, the relevant NMS for boarding, if we can just very quickly look at those so we're clear at the standards which you were inspecting against. The first one, which is relevant, is 2, which is Ralph ISI 001555 at 5. Chair and panel, if you're interested, it's tab 10 of bundle B of your core bundle. So standard 2 was the first one the DfE asked you about. So that's about induction for boarders, choice of staff for personal guidance or help with a personal problem, and the school identifies at least one person other than a parent outside the boarding and teaching staff who boarders may contact directly about personal problems or concerns at school. Person ensures that the boarders know who the person is and how to contact them, and that they're provided with appropriate helplines. Now, as I understand it, it was in fact Manchester Children's Services that were responsible. They decided that they were going to take responsibility for standard 2. That's right, isn't it?
I have to say there was so much overlap.
We'll come back to that later, but I just thought it's useful to get the standard up,
yeah,
so we're clear about what we're looking at here.
I certainly have in my notes of that, and I remember discussing with the head and the chair of governors about the independent listener and
right,
what their role already was in school.
Okay. I think we'll come back in a minute when we talk about the findings you made about the independent listener service, some more questions about that as a whole. We've then got NMS 11, Ralph ISI 001558. Yeah, and it's highlighted. The school ensures that. Why is it highlighted? It's highlighted in the document. If we look, Ralph, do you mind getting up standard 11, child protection? So that's highlighted in the guidance. Is that because that's the central standard? Or do we not?
I'm afraid I don't know.
No. Okay.
I don't know the highlighting.
No. Okay. So as far as the situation is concerned, this was something else, Ms. Coley, that you had to judge against. I can see it's quite broad. Ms. Richards, is it too broad, that standard?
Broad or all-encompassing, and of course it references very, very specifically the statutory guidance by ministers. So that includes, of course, keeping children safe in education and working together. So it's pinned very directly on to the independent school standards regulations.
And what do you understand have regard to any guidance to mean?
The short answer is that it must be followed unless there is very good reason not to.
Okay.
And it is rare, I would say, to see any genuine reason that that should not be followed.
Right. And that's your understanding. Do you think that's the understanding of schools as far as statutory guidance is concerned as well?
I think it has increasingly become so, yes. And we certainly make it very clear to schools in our guidance and what we say that that it must be followed unless they have good reason not to.
And if we can go down, Ralph, if you wouldn't mind getting up 13, 14 and 15 of the standards, which you as well had to look at. 13's right at the bottom of the same page, Ralph. 14 and 15 are at the top of the next page. So, these are the other things. You have to look at the management and leadership of practice and development, Ms. Coley, that senior yes. boarding staff have adequate experience and that the records specified in Appendix 2 are maintained and monitored by the school. Just in brief, what are those records?
Oh, things like monitoring the safeguarding records, monitoring the recruitment checks, monitoring behaviour logs, complaints logs, all of those sorts of
okay.
things.
And staff recruitment, that's obviously that they follow the relevant guidance, which at that time would have, well, in fact, in 2013, I think it would have been the first iteration of keeping children safe in education.
No, that was 14.
14, so it
yeah,
was the,
April 14.
The pre...
So it was safeguarding children and safer recruitment in education.
Right. And then criminal records check for those who live on the school. And then if we can go to the next page, please, Ralph, just the top of it, which is the end of 14, beginning of 15. So the end of 14, written agreement about those who live with boarders in respect of any offending, supervision of visitors, suitability of arrangements for guardians. Now, again, we're going to come back to the issue of guardians when we actually go through the inspection, but just maybe for... just to clarify, a guardian is somebody who looks after an international student or a student whose parents are not resident in the UK outside of term time.
Yes.
Yes. And we'll talk a little bit about the mechanism for that later. So can we go to 15 now, Ralph? So this, again, is all about staffing. And really, it's about boarding staffing, so that there's the right number of people of the right qualifications. And 15.5, that staff know the whereabouts of their boarders or how to find their whereabouts in their charge at all times. I suspect that's something that's changed quite radically, as now with Find My iPhone, you can find them wherever they are, whereas 15 years ago, that might have been slightly more challenging. And that they have a policy in relation to children going missing, and that there's at least one adult member of staff that sleeps in each boarding house at night. So that's 15. And then 17 and 18, Ralph, that's 10. That's both on 10. It's in the middle of the page, Ralph. Would you mind? Yes. Boarders have an opportunity to contribute their views. Pupils are not penalised for raising a concern, and that there is an appropriate complaints policy. Right. So, sort of turning generally, can I just ask a couple of general questions about these standards? They're called national minimum standards rather than national quality standards. Are these a floor standard? Or are they a what you aspire to?
They're a floor standard. So if the standards are met, then the intention is that all children will be safe and well educated. So they are designed to give a clarity and an assurance to ministers actually, but to everybody, that children are safe.
However, there was a situation, certainly under these regulations, whereby you could fail one of these, you could not comply, or they are not met. I believe you say the standards are met or the standards are not met is the terminology you use, but yet you wouldn't necessarily fail an inspection. Is that still the case, or has that changed?
That's the difference between the way that we inspect and the way our reports operate. So ISI reports report on the individual regulation, and there is a met or not met. We don't give an overall grade against the regulatory requirements.
Right. And why don't you give an overall grade against the regulatory requirements?
But the intention is that it makes it crystal clear for everyone about what is not happening, or indeed what is happening, and therefore enables, where necessary, enforcement action or further action to be taken against those standards.
Yes. Because just to be clear, you are an inspector, you are not a regulator.
Exactly.
So any decisions, any conclusions from any reports go back to the Department for Education, and it's then their job to take action against it. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Now, one of the concerns that's been raised, less so within the what I would call the mainstream boarding sector, but certainly within the special schools sector, is that these standards, being a floor standard, aren't good enough. And that there should be the development of a quality standard, which should not just be the basics, but should be this is good and this is what every school should meet. Do you have any particular views about that?
I think if the argument is we wish to raise the bar of what is good enough for our children, then we would be entirely in agreement that actually what is good enough. Do I think that we need levels of a grading system? I'm not sure that that makes children safer. I think it's about what is that floor standard and making sure that that is high enough, which is what makes children safer.
Okay. And I certainly know the NMS, the 2002 version, were about 100 pages long, and it then reduced in 2011, and then, in fact, it reduced again in 2015. The 2002 NMS were much more prescriptive in terms of what had to be had and much more detailed. And I don't know whether it's Miss Coley or Miss Richards can best answer this. Was that level of prescription in the 2002 NMS helpful or unhelpful? Because some of the teaching unions have said, actually, we'd like a bit more prescription of what should be in there.
So perhaps if I may answer broadly, and then perhaps Ms. Coley's got something to add in terms of the 2002. I think that where the greater the detail and the greater the prescription, the greater number of loopholes there are as well. I think the breadth and the all-encompassing nature of the way it is written now enables us to inspect in terms of the welfare of the children, outcomes for children, and that culture that is being talked about so much at the moment. And I think that breadth enables that to happen.
That's very helpful. Thank you very much for those broad questions. Turning now again to focus upon the 2013 inspection of Cheetham's. Miss Coley, oh, sorry, I haven't let you answer the question. I've moved on.
No, that's fine. Because I was not inspecting boarding schools before the NMSs were slimmed down. I didn't inspect until 2012.
Fine. Miss Coley, we have your visit plan. Ralph, ISI 00153. No, that's not that. Let's forget about that. As I understand, there were two issues which you in particular focused upon, Miss Coley. One, recruitment, selection and supervision of staff, including DBS checks. And two, complaints, policies and procedures, including referrals to the LADO, guardianship and reports to the governing body.
Yes.
And the Manchester Children's Services were to lead on safeguarding policy, training and securing pupils' views. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
And as I understand it, can we just double check, would the referrals to the LADO obviously in this case you have Manchester Children's Services on site with you, so they would have provided you with information. What was the usual practice at that time in terms of contacting a LADO in the case of a boarding welfare inspection before the inspection took place?
Would not be done directly by the reporting inspector, the lead inspector, but the office at ISI. My understanding is that they always contact the LADO before any inspection takes place to find out the LADO's view of the way the school operates with them, what communication is like between them and the school, and whether they have had any issues that have come to light. And that information would be passed to the RI if there were any concerns.
But can I just ask, they're not under any obligation to respond to you, are they?
Who, the LADO?
Yeah. Miss Richards might.
No, they're not, and Liz is correct. So in 2011, we would send a generic email. That's then been refined to be a school-specific email, and we now, in discussion with the National LADO Network, have refined it further to be a form where we ask very specific questions about the engagement of the school with the LADOs. But to answer your direct question, no, there is no formal requirement for the LADO to respond to us.
Do you think there should be, and what value does it add when the LADO does respond to you?
I certainly think that it is any information that we get adds value to the inspection, because it allows our inspection teams to triangulate the information and evidence that they're getting.
And as far as DBS checks are concerned, I understand you checked the central staff register, Miss Coley, during the course of this inspection and checked whether or not all the relevant DBS checks or the reference checks had been made. Yes. Is that something which you would always do?
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay. Every inspection.
Okay. And to also identify, how many inspectors were on site in total during this 2013 inspection?
There were two of us from ISI, and there were four from Manchester, I believe, and one from Barnardo's.
Right. So there were sort of seven inspectors in total over 2 days.
Yes.
And how many inspectors would there usually be over how many days?
Well, remembering that this was a completely unique inspection, on a normal ISI inspection, depending on the size of the school, you would have had the lead inspector and then probably anything between 3 and 7 inspectors, depending on the size of the school.
Right. Okay. Now, Miss Coley, before you went into the school, you analysed the school's safeguarding policies. Ralph, I think this is at ISI 001533. I think that's the document you just got up, but I might be wrong about that. Yes. Yeah. This is analysis of child protection and safeguarding policies. So when did you do this, Miss Coley?
I think it was mid-February. I could look up the date, but I think it was about mid-February.
Okay.
About the 17th of February 2013.
Okay. So this was you going through and identifying particular issues that you'd noted within the policies themselves. So let's just take a couple of examples.
Now, hang on. This is my actual analysis.
Yes.
I was thinking for a minute it was the policy, but
no, it's
my actual analysis.
Yeah.
My writing.
Yeah. So, specific mention of the general status and authority. There doesn't say anything about the note of the training received by the head. Ralph, can we go to the bottom of the page? Other strongly recommended elements are missing and not clear. No clear procedures to be followed for dealing with abuse by one or more pupils. The school's reporting arrangements within 24 hours of a disclosure. So you had carefully gone through and identified, I think we see in some detail, exactly what needed to be added to and what was missing. Is that something, again, that you and other inspectors would do before every inspection?
At that time, yes. The reporting inspector was expected to analyse the safeguarding policy before every inspection and to raise with the school issues that were not there, and to then make sure that the implementation was secure. And if that was the case, then they would be advised to put their policy right to match the implementation. Yeah. But these days, since 2014, that job has been undertaken by a team in the ISI office of the analysis of the policies. But the RI is still expected to do their own analysis and to check that they're, you know, that it is secure.
So really, in advance of any school visit, yeah, you would look through that to make sure that they, and then you would check against it to see if they were actually doing it in practice.
That's right.
How would you do that?
Oh, there are all sorts of ways. I mean, as far as recruitment checks are concerned, looking at the single central register, one would have an interview with the DSL and go through with them what issues that they'd had, how they'd dealt with them, how quickly they had gone to the local authority for advice or had spoken to the LADO about if it was an allegation against staff and so on. You would talk to the pupils, how safe did they feel. The pupil and parent questionnaires were often helpful, and it only needed for one parent or one pupil to raise an issue about safeguarding or bullying before we would be looking at that very carefully indeed on an inspection.
Okay. Now, the conclusions that you reached in your full inspection report are actually very helpfully summarised within your witness statement, or in fact the witness statement of Miss Richards. So that's Ralph, ISI 001576 at 0112 to 013. It's paragraph 27. Yes. Ralph, would you mind getting up both pages? Because it flows on, the table flows onto the next page. So if you can get up 13 as well and then put it, yes. So you deal in some more detail further on in the witness statement, so I'm not going to take you line by line, but I thought this would be a convenient way for us to look at the findings that you made. So the first finding I'm going to ask you to look at is that the oversight of child protection, so this is the under the general standard 7.8 and NMS 11, proprietor must ensure the annual review of the policy and the efficiency, which is undertaken by the FEFIs, I believe they're called, or FIFIs, and the school committee, ensure full implementation of the child protection policy and ensure all required recruitment checks are carried out in advance of contractor staff. Now, your conclusion and concern was that the FEFIs, who were trustees, and who, as I understand it, made up some of the governing body, but they were the registered proprietor with the Department for Education,
yes,
as I understand it.
Yes.
Because we've heard from Miss Morland before the break that she said, well, I'm not really sure why the FIFIs were required to do this, because, in fact, it's the governing body. But I think you then wrote, in fact, I think the DfE, and you clarified with them to say, no, actually, the registered proprietor, who's the person, DfE has a list, don't they? And
yes,
the registered proprietor were the FEFIs, FUFIs, whatever you want to call them. Apologies to anyone who is one. That, in fact, it was them and not the trustees who had ultimate responsibility. Is that right?
Yes,
not the governing body, sorry.
Yeah.
Not the school committee.
I think
committee.
The FEFIs were the trustees.
Yeah, the FEFIs are the trustees, but they weren't the school committee, which I think was the school's word for what we would know as a governing body.
Yeah, that's what I would call a local governing body,
yes,
in a sense. Yes, the FEFIs would be the people who, by law, are responsible for ensuring that the regulations are kept at the school if they are the registered proprietor with the DfE. And that indeed was the case. There was a lot of discussion about this afterwards, I believe, between ISI and the DfE.
Yes. But what you in effect found was that there hadn't been an annual appraisal or review, or the governors weren't really scrutinising or acting as a critical friend in respect of safeguarding.
What, having reread some of the evidence forms,
yes,
what I remember is that the governing body, as such, had done a review, but what I discovered was that whilst they had looked at the policy, they had not actually discussed in any great detail the efficiency with which the duties were being discharged.
Right. So they'd looked at the policy, said, that looks okay, but hadn't then sat there and said to the head or called the designated safeguarding lead in, which is a role which would have existed, I think, at that time,
yes,
and said, what's going on, what are you doing, can we have a look at this case, that case, to examine what's happening?
Not enough challenge of what was happening, and the minutes of their annual review indicated that the policy was what they had focused on rather than the efficiency of the way in which the duties of the DSL are being discharged, and that is part of the requirement of governing of the responsible proprietor.
Yes. So is this usual? I mean, I suppose there's a question here, which is the failing, it was the failing as you perceived it of Cheetham's at that time, is that fairly common in respect of governors, Miss Coley or Miss Richards, to answer that? Is it common for governors just to look at the policy rather than really try and scrutinise what's going on in the school?
I think it can be a problem. But we try very hard when we are talking to governors, and one of the roles I do as a consultant now is to train some governors in their responsibility in safeguarding and to encourage them to make sure that they do check that not only is the policy accurate, but it is being implemented properly. That is absolutely crucial, and that they check that the DSL is going to the local authority as fast as they should do if there is a concern, allegation or disclosure.
And if there is a failure to meet a standard, does that therefore mean that the governors have failed in their duty of oversight?
Yes. In short.
Okay, that's fine. Miss Richards, can I ask you the same question that I asked Miss Coley, which is this kind of failing common within the sector which you inspect, or is it unusual to have a board of governors who presented in the way that those from Cheetham's did?
I think there have been increasing expectations on governing bodies, actually both in our sector and in the maintained sector, about the level of challenge, of scrutiny, of support, but actually of ensuring that the team, the head and the senior leadership team, are doing what needs to be done and ensuring that the standards are met. Is it common? I would say that... it is not uncommon. I'm not sure that I could give you a percentage.
No. But do you think that governors know what it is they should know, so to speak? Are the expectations too high of what governors are meant to know on the basis that, as I understand it, and this is evidence that AGBIS, who are the Association of Governing Bodies of Independent Schools, have given us, is they say there should be robust scrutiny and that governors should have the same training as staff in safeguarding, but there is no requirement of any governor, in fact, not just in the independent sector, but also in the maintained sector, to undergo particular forms of training in safeguarding.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think governing bodies vary massively in terms of their knowledge, skills, understanding, and, in fact, the training which they're required to undergo.
Do you think that there should be explicit requirements for some kind of minimum or baseline training for their benefit as well as for the school's benefit?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think a lot of schools do. A lot of schools do that now. That is becoming more and more. Yeah.
And the other issue, which really I think Mr. Scorer from Slater and Gordon has raised on behalf of his clients, who are the victims and survivors, is whether or not, certainly in the independent school sector, often governors come from people who are part and parcel of a trustee, so they'll often be members of the body which would originally have found the school, or tend to be made up of what could be called the great and the good, so to speak, who all know each other. Do you think that that therefore means that governance and independent schools can all be a bit cosy? A bit cosy and not challenging enough?
I think it depends, again, on individual governing bodies and the challenges they've set themselves in terms of their own training and the advice and interactions with people who do know. That what I would say is that the very best governing bodies do not behave like that. They take the training, they understand what they need to do. The prevalence, I'm not sure I can...
But because obviously one of the concerns is, and I think one heard this in Miss Morland when she said, well, so-and-so, he was on the governing body and he was the head of the Royal Northern College of Music. Now, one understands why you would have a governor from the Royal Northern College of Music. And in fact, they've also got the canon of Manchester Cathedral, who, in fact, Robert Waddington was somebody against whom allegations of child sexual abuse were made. And we've dealt with that in another investigation in this inquiry. Can you understand why, from an outsider's perspective, it all seems like an establishment club, so to speak, in the context of independent school governance?
I was just going to say, I think it is fair to, having been a governor of three independent schools, I think it is fair to say that independent school governing bodies are becoming more and more conscious of making sure that they do have the expertise on that board, and it's not so much the great and the good as it used to be. Some still are.
Yes.
But I think there is a move towards looking for expertise from among the parental body, perhaps, from within the local area, or even from further afield, and getting a good representation of skills that governors can bring to their role of governorship.
So, I mean, largely, it doesn't really matter if they're great and good, as long as they act as a critical friend and they provide the appropriate level of challenge.
Yes.
Do you think independent school governors understand the need for challenge?
More
broadly
more.
Or specifically?
Increasingly.
Mm. Right.
And some will and some won't.
Okay. You say increasingly. Is that because it's the exception rather than the rule, or...?
I think nationally, our understanding of not only safeguarding is increasing, but I think there is also an increasing understanding in governing bodies about their roles and their responsibilities, which cuts across all sectors, and in terms of what they must do in order to fulfil their duties as a governing body.
Yeah, because, of course, the governors have ultimate responsibility, as they're
Indeed.
Usually the trustees, in terms of they will have fiduciary responsibilities very often in the independent sector. They will also have responsibilities to the Charity Commission. But as well, all the research tells us that positive safeguarding starts from the top. And the top in an independent school is usually the governing body, or if it doesn't have one, the proprietor. So does that therefore mean there needs to be an especial emphasis upon leading from the top in respect of safeguarding? And do you think that governors understand that?
I think there absolutely needs to be a leading from the top, but that's not to dismiss the importance of that then running like a stick of rock through everything that the school does and is. I think both are vital.
But to sort of take another term, which is, in this case with Cheetham's, we had a governing body, but there's no requirement upon any independent school to have a governing body. Now, AGBIS, who have given us evidence, they've said they would like all independent schools to have, at the very least, an advisory board or an advisory body, because they have concerns about a proprietor wearing too many hats, so there's not the level of independent scrutiny. Is this something that you, as the ISI, who are likely to inspect the vast majority of schools which fall into that category, do you have any concerns about what I would call the owner-proprietor model?
I think the issue is exactly the one you've outlined, that it is about the extent to which that owner-proprietor takes advice, gets that challenge, and how they do so to ensure that they are not the only source of decision-making, but that there are systems, that they put systems in place to challenge their own thinking and to ask those robust questions.
And Miss Richards, Ralph, could you get up ISI 001574, which should be paragraph 218 of your witness statement? Oh, 049. Yes, it's actually right. Some schools have additional layers of governance, you then say at 219. ISI does not maintain an exhaustive list of these, but a few examples are. And you talk about those with an overarching parent company, schools which are parts of companies with many corporate layers, schools linked to university colleges. And I think in paragraph 218, you've also talked about directors based abroad and those with a head office. What particular difficulties in respect of governance and management do those structures make in terms of ensuring accountability in respect of safeguarding?
So there's something around the appropriate checks which may or may not be made about proprietors. And then in addition, in terms of where legal responsibility sits and how that plays out, and those complexities are sometimes a challenge to us as the inspectorate.
Okay. So, Ms. Coley, now turning back to you, I'd like to go back to the specifics and look at the information about any referrals that have been made to the LADO. Now, we've dealt with this in evidence, Ms. Neil dealt with this in evidence in respect of Ms. Moreland. Could we get up, I think it's ISI 00139213. No, that isn't the document I need. I'm just going to ask Ms. Neild. 00156211. We can get that one up first. That's the second document I need. Ralph, that you've just got up for me, I apologise. So this is the document that we took Ms. Moreland to this morning. Can we go to the bottom, please, Ralph? Please indicate. So this is information, this is a form. Can you just explain what this form is, who it gets sent to and who's meant to fill it in, Ms. Coley?
Right, it's an electronic form which is available for all schools and they are expected to fill it in preparation for an inspection. In those days, because they had more notice of inspection, it would probably be done just before the inspection. These days, they're expected to keep this type of form up to date so that when the inspection is announced, they can send it very quickly to the reporting inspector. And this last box is about mentioning any referral that would be made. Now, I would just like to take your attention, if I may, to the Manchester Safeguarding Review that happened in 2013. And on page 5...
At the bottom of the page, the bottom of your page, if you want to take me to a document, at the bottom...
No, so it's, I can tell you, it's CSM 000326.
Yes.
If we may just have a look at page 5 and Roman 9.
Yep.
Ms. Moreland did say that she put not applicable in that box because she thought it referred to only accusations, allegations that had been made since the last inspection. Yep. But in fact, here under 9, we can see that there had been an allegation only 2 or 3 weeks before the inspection, which had not been declared. And that pre-inspection information would only have been sent to me as the RI a matter of 2 or 3 days, because the inspection, I think they were only given something like 4 or 5 days' notice of the inspection.
Ralph, can we go back to the previous document, which is the answer by Ms. Moreland, 00156211?
Sorry.
And it says, Ms. Moreland had said, please indicate any cases where a member of staff or other person connected with the school is subject to investigation, has resigned or has been dismissed or disciplined because of questionable conduct with children. Now, is that meant to be since the last ISI inspection, which was the explanation that Ms. Moreland was given? I mean, one can see in the next sentence, it plainly says any referral to the DfE made since the last inspection. What's the first sentence meant to mean? Ms. Coley?
I think it does. We have always taken that to mean since the last inspection, because clearly they would have signed this prior to the previous inspection. So anything that had been raised would have been dealt with and looked into at that inspection. So this, I think schools do take this, in my view, probably rightly, to mean since the last inspection. Yeah, yeah. But I was just pointing out that, in fact, there was an allegation that had not been brought to our attention and which was found on the inspection.
Yeah. So on the inspection, you then went and spoke to the head about whether or not there had been any referrals or any problems, had anybody been subject to investigation? And this was the document I got up a little while ago, ISI 00139213.
Right.
Yes.
And I think if I can take you to the top.
Yes.
Has the school taken any disciplinary action or issued a suspension or... So these are... Can I just double check? Whose notes are these?
They're mine. My writing.
Right. And I'm assuming, is this a verbatim note? Is it a minuted
right.
note? Is it contemporaneous? Does it happen afterwards?
No. This is... For me, as an inspector, I plan. I'm afraid I'm fastidious about planning what I want to ask and so on. And I will have prepared this form, leaving little gaps, before I went in to see the head. But this particular question is a question that I have to sign against to say that I have asked this question of the head on the front of the inspection checklist, which must then be sent to the DfE, and I have to sign against that. So for me, I always made sure that on an inspection, I had written this on the form so that I read it word for word in the way that I would then have to sign had I asked the head this question.
Right.
And what I did in this particular instance, I was surprised that none had been declared, which is why I dated and signed it, my initials, because
EPC,
I wanted to be absolutely clear that that's what I had heard. And
okay.
My colleague was with me and she heard the same thing.
Right. Can we go further down the page, please, Ralph? Can we go to the bottom of the page? So this is your, what does it all add up to?
Mm. Yes. Now, the what does it all add up to probably was written, I have to say, this is what happens in the hotel at night, because you have to, your basic stuff is there, and you're then pulling together what does it all add up to. And that's why I will have put did not acknowledge suspensions or discipline in proceedings at this stage.
Right.
Hoping that by the next day,
okay,
because
so,
we've been advised.
So, Miss Coley, what did you in fact know about issues there were with discipline and suspension, and who had given you that information?
Well, obviously there had been a lot in the public domain, but I think because of this one that I've just mentioned,
the
in the Manchester one, because
February
we were talking with the Manchester team all the time, then information would have come to us that in fact there had been a recent note. And on one of my evidence forms somewhere else, I actually make the comment about 1-3 weeks ago.
Yes.
So we obviously knew that something had come up, and we were surprised that this hadn't been revealed to us.
Okay. So we then turned to, at that stage it was said, no, there are none. You then went back the next day, as I understand it, and you spoke to the chair as well as that. And this is ISI 001576 at 016, I think. Sorry, I've scrawled some handwritten notes where there's... It's, no, that's not right. I'm going to ask Miss Neild if she can help me. I'm looking for the notes where the head says she doesn't understand. Yes. If we can just hold on 2 minutes. Right, well, while we get this up, you can perhaps explain to me, what did the head say at that point in time when she was with the Chair of Governors? You posed the question that we've just seen again. What was said?
She said that she hadn't heard... first of all, she said that I hadn't said it the day before. And my colleague said, yes, Mrs. Coley has just said it in exactly the same way as she said it yesterday. And then she said, oh, well, she hadn't understood or she hadn't heard it properly the day before, something along those lines.
Right. In fact, it's ISI 001489, which was what I had in my original note, but then had scrubbed over. So I apologise, that's completely my fault.
Sorry.
That's okay. So this is final meeting with the head and chair of governors. Again, is it usual for you to meet with the head and chair of governors together at the end of any inspection?
Yes, we would normally have a final meeting when we would bring to them the findings. I don't remember quite why we didn't have a final meeting. I don't remember that, because in our planning, the Manchester services and we had agreed that we would have a final meeting. I think it was between 3 and 4 o'clock, which was on the original timetable. But I think we may well have said to the Manchester team, we really need to go back. We had been, it had been suggested to us by the chief inspector, who we had alerted the night before that we hadn't received the response that we wanted, and she had said, go back and ask again. And because I knew the chair of governors would be there, I thought I will ask the head again in front of the chair of governors, which is why I did so. And that was when she did say, yes, there had been four that she
and
mentioned.
And she said she had not properly understood yesterday.
Yes, and if you look down under number three, about the sixth line down, I say one 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
Which would match what the Manchester Children's Services were saying.
Now, can I just ask, obviously in this case, you knew that there had been a referral 3 weeks ago because you were involved with Manchester Children's Services. Had you not had that information, which is likely, would you have known to re-ask that question, Miss Coley?
I mean, you would say to the head, are you sure you have not had anything? You must declare it if you have. But, I mean, you know, other than that, you have to rely on the head telling you the truth.
Right. Which
unless
then,
you have any previous information.
Right. And how often would you say, on the whole, do you have previous information? Is it spotty, the information you get given, patchy, spotty, whatever you want to call it, or is it usual that you've got quite good information from the Lado, from the DfE, from the Charity Commission, from other people who might have background info about a particular school?
Well, if you have the information, it does make it a lot easier. I wouldn't like to hazard hand what percentage we get that on. From the inspections that I've done, very rarely.
Right.
But that's not to say that there was any information to pass on.
Okay. So what did you think about the head's view that she hadn't heard properly or understood yesterday? Did you reach any particular conclusions about that?
My own personal opinion would be this is highly unusual and slightly, I suppose I might use the word, am I allowed to use the word dodgy?
You're allowed to use whatever word you like as long as it's... right.
Unusual, certainly.
OK. Now, Miss Richards, you raise some general issues which really the Checks case points out, which is about the fact that there is a relatively weak requirement upon individuals to provide you with information. Now, I don't think we need to get it up, but Regulation 24.1G of the Independent School Standards Regulations identifies the information which you can be asked, and it does indicate that the standard about the provision of information is met if the proprietor ensures that any information reasonably requested in connection with an inspection under Section 162A, the regs have now changed, the Act's now changed, but nothing turns on that, which is required for the purposes of the inspection, and access to the school's admission and attendance register is provided to the body conducting the inspection. So I suppose the question in my mind is that good enough in terms of information requirements, or do you think you need more in order to be able to get under and find out what's going on in a school?
So I think that was intended to enable inspectors to have access to records, information and so on. And I suppose the short answer is, no, I don't think it is sufficient. And I think that leads us into the discussions, the many discussions about mandatory reporting and indeed the duty of candour. And that being a duty on an individual and an institution, indeed, to declare, to disclose and to share any information which might have some bearing on the independent school standards as we see it.
Right. Okay, so as I understand it, in your witness statement, Ralph, it might be useful just to get this up, 0001574, and it's at 065, it's paragraph 297. You identify that the Independent Schools Inspectorate would like to see a new duty of candour on schools and individuals to proactively inform inspectorates of anything that might affect inspection judgments.
Yes.
And is that precisely for the sorts of reasons that we've seen this morning?
Exactly for those reasons, yes.
Okay. And do you think that that would solve the problem that's been identified both in this case and in other cases of individuals not telling you things which they really should tell you?
We think it's one part, potentially, of the solution. And I think it works alongside other requirements, such as mandatory reporting, potentially, and which are emerging during this inquiry. So we see it as a potential way of requiring and expecting and raising those expectations that schools do not furnish that which is asked of them, but are proactive in supplying us with information.
And also in this case, I think there was an identification that a school had carried out a disciplinary investigation without informing the LADO. Again, is that something which happens regularly or is that quite unusual?
Where schools are found non-compliant, then that is often, I would say, part of those issues.
How good do you think independent schools are at liaising with the LADO and at LADOs at liaising with them? Because it's a cooperative, it's a mutual situation. I think I'm probably going to ask both of you that question. Miss Richards, if you could answer first, and then Miss Cooley.
So we've already identified that we don't always have responses from LADOs in terms of the information that we ask them. But from the responses we do get, I think it's something in the region of 8% of schools have little or very little, no contact with the LADO at all. A greater number do have some contact and do make referrals. But that's based on a fairly low sample response rate.
Again, I think this is one of the things that is improving over time. When I talk to schools, I talk to the DSL about how good are your links with the LADO. Do you know who it is? Have you invited them into school? Are you in touch with them on a regular basis? And I would say that that is improving over time. But it varies from region to region.
There's one other matter, which is, I understand you do get given information by the Disclosure and Barring Service and by the DfE about any particular concerns or anybody who's been barred, who has already been barred, who's on the list. But if a referral has been made to the DBS, would the DBS tell you that a referral had been made prior to a barring decision being made?
No.
No. And is that something which causes a problem? Because I'm just thinking it can take, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 years for something to go from a referral to a barring decision being made.
Of course, it's very difficult to know what we don't know.
Yes.
And whether there have been issues that have occurred as a result in that interim period. But logic would say where there has been sufficient concern that a referral has been made, and for a period of 2 or 3 years potentially before that decision is made by the TRA now, then it seems to me fairly clear that that is too long a gap and, yes, has significant potential to be a problem.
Right. Now, can I ask, Ofsted had gone in and inspected the boarding welfare element of the school in 2011 and they had described it as good. You, in your witness statement, Miss Richards, Miss Coley, identify some concerns with the 2011 report, and this is at paragraph 58 of your witness statement, which is, and you identified that there were some concerns that you had about the Ofsted 2011 report, particularly in respect of staff recruitment and checking. Ms. Coley, would you like to tell us about that?
Well, only that when I looked at the single central register, it was obvious that there were issues that were obvious from before that last inspection.
Right. And your review and records can be seen at Ralph ISI 001544, I think. No? Can we go ISI 001487? No, sorry, let's not forget about that. So there was a record of that, and you identified that in 2013 there had been some issues. In 2011 there would have been issues which, had the central register been checked, should have been identified. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And is that something, do you always check the central register?
We all, on every ISI inspection, the single central register is checked. Normally, we would start from the newest staff appointed and work backwards, if you see what I mean, so that we want to know, well, are the school clear in their recruitment checks recently? And would you agree?
Yes.
That's the way you still do it. Go back, as it were, go backwards. But on this inspection, sometimes schools present their single central register in alphabetical order, which means that it's not in the order in which people have been appointed. So therefore, your eyes are alighting on people who sometimes have been there some time. And then you see things and you think, oh dear, you can see I put circles around them.
Okay.
Or highlight them or whatever.